Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode of the Brexit Podcast. I'm your host Jennifer Han, and with so much news rolling in, or more like flooding in every day, it's incredibly hard to keep up with what is happening in the world of British politics right now. That's why Tim brought on our good friend and recurring guest Ian Dunt, who has literally written the book on Brexit, to make us all feel a bit more well-informed. If you enjoy the show and you want to stay on top of our future Brexit developments, please feel free to subscribe wherever you're listening to this podcast. And you can also find us at brexitpodcast.com and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Brexit Podcast.
Ian, thank you so much for joining us back on the Brexit Podcast. There's so many issues we could discuss around Brexit. Everything is inextricably linked to it. Let's start with, what's this proposed new cross-party Brexit Commission? Isn't there already a Brexit Select Committee that were filing loads of reports?
Yeah, and Barry Gardner for Labour keeps on making this point, saying, well, look, we've already got the Select Committee. I mean, I don't really get that. I mean, committees are for scrutiny. Commons committees are basically for scrutinising decisions. You put forward ideas of how the government might be able to do it better by speaking to experts. If there was a cross-party Brexit committee, that would not be a scrutiny committee. That would be a very, very different kettle of fish. That would be people from all parties, or maybe just the Conservatives and Labour, getting together and trying to come up with some idea of what it is that they are actually trying to achieve. I think it's more likely that that would be a priorities discussion rather than an outcome discussion. In other words, you wouldn't be saying, we're trying to stay in the customs union. You would say our priorities are on jobs and trade, and the eventual outcome would follow from those priorities. But that would be a pretty different kettle of fish. And we're not there yet. I mean, it doesn't quite seem like there's full agreement yet, but the noise is almost sort of day by day, almost hour by hour, seem to be getting more positive in that direction from ministers. So yesterday we had David Davis started the day saying, look, Brexit policy is completely unchanged. By the time it came to sort of midday, he was starting to say, well, you know, I've still got my door open to Labour, to Keir Starmer, the shadow Brexit secretary, if he wants to come talk to me. This morning on the Today programme, Michael Gove, sort of, you know, dyed in the wool Brexiter, was starting to say, well, look, we may have some conversations with others, we're open to other ideas. And so there's nothing formal yet, but the mood music is definitely there.
Where's that coming from then? Is this the influence of the dreaded DUP?
You know, it could be. It could be a sort of a clear appreciation of the fact that if Theresa May says, I want to have a band-aid for my hard Brexit plan, and she then goes to the country and doesn't get it, it therefore follows that she cannot deliver on that plan. There has to be a change to that plan, even though they're not willing to say that. Remember that for a long time, George Osborne, while pursuing a variety of economic strategies, would refuse to say that he was pursuing a plan B, even though he quite plainly was pursuing a plan B for the second half of the 2010 Parliament. So you don't always necessarily say that you're changing, even when you are changing. However, it could be more cynical than that. We are currently in a situation where there's no party, no overall majority. They're about to undergo some of the most bruising negotiations this country has done since the end of the Second World War. I mean, this is stuff that would affect almost every aspect of our society, that will upset people across society, from vets to the meat industry to the aviation industry. And then no matter who you are, you're probably going to be affected by these talks. And it could be that Tories are thinking, well, you know what, let's share some of this, you know, trouble that's going to come our way, and actually spread it around a little bit. It could be as cynical as that, or it could be more high-minded and a recognition of the election result.
Makes some kind of sense. Would you'd be in favour then, would you, of this sort of cross-party Brexit commission?
I don't see what other options we have right now, really. You know, another election does not seem like a very sensible way to proceed. Theresa May did us the considerable disservice of triggering Article 50 before she held the elections. And not only does she lose the 2 months of the election, the crucial months that we desperately needed to make the most of, but she also managed to then go ahead and not win it. So by the end of it, we came out with no idea of even what we were trying to achieve, let alone which government was going to send people to go to the talks next Monday, or which people they were going to send and on what basis. So, you know, we're basically now right back at year zero, days before talks begin. And it's hard to see any other way of doing it, really. There's no real time for a Tory leadership contest.
Yeah.
So one thinks, well, that seems like the right way to go. However, there are real dangers here. I mean, it's unclear that thing would be able to hold firm. It's unclear that people would have the same priorities, even though Labour and the Tory position on Brexit are not actually a million miles away. And the main thing to avoid is trying to have our team break down halfway through the talks. It's much better to take time now to try and sort out our position, regardless of what the position is, than that it all breaks up in a year's time. That is the real sort of catastrophe eventuality. And that's when we really are going to find ourselves in an awful lot of trouble.
Just on the Brexit negotiations, if, you know, drying goat skins and funny horse racing hats and the Queen's, you know, days out to Ascot can delay the Queen's speech, can't the Brexit negotiations be delayed too?
Yes, they can be. And the, you know, the kind of messages that are coming in from Europe, exasperated and infuriated though they are clearly saying that, yes, you can delay. The thing is, it's in our problem to delay. I mean, we are the ones that suffer the more severe repercussions if we drop out without any deal. Of course, this has not been the way that the debate has been communicated for the last year, where it's made out as if it would be absolutely fine to leave with no deal. The truth is, it would not be fine to leave with no deal. We haven't, and you and I have discussed this before, but we don't have the regulatory infrastructure up in place in order to do that. And the only time that you can know which regulators you need to set up, for instance, regulators on financial services surveillance, regulators on the handling of nuclear material, regulators on authorising drugs for the market, I mean, stuff across society that if they're not there, you've got a major problem. And the only way to do that is if to know what the deal is, and therefore would we need those regulators. So, no, this is suboptimal, to put it as mildly as I possibly can. But we are the ones that are going to face the most considerable sort of consequences of it falling apart. So, it's yes, we can go whenever we want for those talks. The only thing we risk is their exasperation. What we really need to do, and I think the priority has to be, is making sure that whoever goes to sit down at those talks has authority back in Westminster to deliver on the things that they say there, has the respect of the people they're talking to across the table in Brussels, and has a clear idea of what they're trying to do. And I mean, let's be clear about just how magnificently catastrophic this is at the moment. It's not, you know, we don't even know what we're trying to achieve out of the talks. Now, to give an idea of the level of complexity of where we should be at, if we hadn't wasted the last 12 months, you know, beating our chests and going on about what a wonderful country we are, we don't just need to do the talks in Brussels. Anything that is happening in Brussels needs to be directly coordinated with the team at the WTO, who are going to be extracting our schedules. Now, that team have got an awful lot of work to do. They need to make sure that as we separate our tariff rate quotas, as we sort out our schedules, we are negotiating in a very intelligent way with the people that export to us. If they don't, we just end up in a series of trade disputes at the WTO if talks fall apart in Brussels. So not only do you need to have a very clear idea of your overall strategy, you need to be coordinating across the world with your team back in Westminster and at the WTO. You need to be making sure that this is happening at multiple levels, not just the broad brushstrokes at the top, but that there's efforts being made to make sure customs authorities are getting to know one another's systems so that when we set ours up, there are no delay. This is really, really technical, very, very difficult. And the fact that right now, we don't even have one side of A4 saying what it is that we're trying to achieve or who's going to be doing it, is extremely concerning.
My next question was what the rest of Europe, how the rest of Europe perceives us currently, but I guess we can now, after what you've just said, stretch that to how the rest of the world perceives us. And I just sense that they might be somewhat bemused at the whole rigmarole that's been happening in the past 12 months.
Yeah, I mean, bemused is at the better end of the scale. I think the thing that's really saving us at the moment is Donald Trump, because he is so catastrophically awful that we look slightly better in comparison than we would do if the Americans had a sane president. But because they don't, we actually at least haven't quite gone so mad as to elect him. The reputation for stability and for good sense and for composure and for patience and for doing things in a proper way and for addressing your own economic vulnerabilities as you proceed, these things, you know, these are reputational assets that I think we probably lost. We can earn them back, but it's going to take us a long time before we repair the damage to our reputation that we suffered over the last 12 months.
Yeah, and in your opinion, can the DUP help? Are you pleased they're now Britain's fourth party and hold the whip hand?
No, they are, I mean, they are poison. You know, it speaks volumes about the fact that here we are now trying to stitch up dirty backdoor deals with these guys. They're poison in any number of ways. I mean, the first one is the insane hypocrisy of the Tories going on about Jeremy Corbyn's, you know, IRA sympathies, and then promptly getting into bed with a bunch of guys who had some very questionable associations with loyalist paramilitaries in Northern Ireland. They're poison on the basis of their social policies, of the things that they've said about gay people, the things that they've said about abortion. They're poison in the fact that they are a bunch of, you know, they're a bunch of true believers. These are religious politicians. This is not like, you know, when they're Brexiters, they're not Brexiters in the same way that even, you know, it's one of those rare moments I have to give Nigel Farage credit. You know, he never brings up God. These guys are the proper sort of Iran wing Brexiters. I mean, they're just a bunch of dreadful lunatics.
I would have to, obviously we haven't got anyone on to defend their position there, but we did have Lembit Opic on Tuesday, and he was painted a slightly different picture, and he said that they were actually quite skilled and pragmatic negotiators in one of the hottest political situations dealing in Northern Ireland that there's been anywhere for decades. And so he was trying to give them a little bit more credit than that. And I obviously have to try and redress the balance slightly.
I completely understand that. But to be honest, I don't think that point, which I don't actually disagree with, necessarily contradicts my own.
Sure.
But it's true that in the situation that they've been in, they know how to do negotiations. In fact, I'm rather more troubled by that fact, because I suspect that they're going to be able to run rings around the Conservative team in handling those negotiations. But what they are is hard right religious fundamentalists with links to paramilitaries. That is simply a point of fact. So we should be dreadfully concerned that they're involved. I mean, we looked at Michael Fallon over the weekend, basically just having all of this filth that they've said about gay people just read out to him, just watching the retoxification of the Tory brand happening second by second. On May's watch, the supreme irony being, of course, she was the one that originally tagged them, the Nasty Party, and told the Conservatives to clean up their act. But there's not really going to be, the DUP are not really going to control social policy in the UK in any meaningful way. That'll be mostly a question of, you know, perception and mood music and guilt by association. What they'll do is they will, by getting into bed with them, will basically completely giving up any notion that the Westminster government can be a neutral arbiter in Northern Ireland. And that seems to me completely catastrophic. You've got stalemate in the Assembly, there's basically no functioning government there. The UK government has done nothing about it. James Brokenshire, the relevant minister, has gone there and said a bunch of words and did absolutely nothing to try and sort that situation. Direct rule didn't happen. They went back to elections. Now, the British government cannot be seen as a neutral arbiter of that situation. It is clearly in bed with one side over another. So that fundamentally gives up its historic responsibility to, above all costs, safeguard the peace in Northern Ireland. That is something that is not being done. It's not being done because Theresa May and the hard Brexiters are desperately trying to stay in power at all costs. And that seems to me one of all the really quite bleak, self-interested things that we have seen from the Conservative Party over the last 12 months. That seems to me one of the absolute worst, and something that they'll be held accountable for in the years to come.
So you're not at all buoyed by the fact that the border issues might be slightly eased with the DUP having some influence and trade between north and south of Ireland? That doesn't give you any kind of plus points at all?
It's possible, but they're not saying anything any less mad on the border in Ireland than anyone else. They've been sat there for ages saying, we want to leave the customs union and we're not going to have a border in Ireland. And you just think, well, you know, anyone can say two mutually incompatible sentences and pretend that they work because they don't have to implement them. Mm. I can say, you know, that I can still go running even though I'm going to saw off one of my legs. It doesn't make it any more true. And that's exactly what they're doing. So you hear this across Ireland, by the way. Talk to some senior officials in the Republic of Ireland, and they'll say the same thing. They'll say, well, look, I'm just telling you now, we're not going to introduce a border. And you think, well, you can say that, mate, but you will. Because at some point, let's say you don't, someone is going to take you to the European Court of Justice, and the European Court of Justice is going to rule that a customs union requires a customs border. This is just a statement of fact. Yeah. And you're going to lose that case, and then you're going to have to do it. So everyone is still lost in this completely mythical assessment where people can say that up is down and pretend that it is the case, but it simply is not the case.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't see anything in the DUP record that suggests that they're any more sane on this issue than anyone else, even though it does seem to affect them more. But then, you know, that's the thing with religious people. Just because something affects them doesn't mean that they'll, you know, go back to their use of reason or logic.
Just a final couple of quick ones, Ian. Thanks again for your time today. On the Great Repeal Bill, again, we had Lembit back on Tuesday. He'd renamed that the Tiny Repeal Bill. The sense that you try and redress European legislation, it's going to fall over because people are going to vote against it from day one, really. Is that how you see that?
Yeah, I mean, that I can't see how they get anything through.
Right.
You know, on whether it's on, you know, the concessions they're going to have to make on Brexit itself, or whether it's the stuff that they're going to be bringing through on the Great Repeal Bill. I mean, you need, you know, there was at least some logic to May's position when she went for that election, which is you need a majority for this stuff, because Brexit is not just one vote, it's vote after vote after vote after vote, and those votes are on emotional, vulnerable areas of people's lives. I mean, that's going to come thick and fast, and I just don't see how they're going to be able to manage any of this stuff. It's just very hard to see how any government manages it, which is partly, there's a couple of people, by the way, talking about this theory, which is basically that one of the reasons people like Boris Gove and if they were rallying around Theresa May is because they want to use her as a human shield.
So, Ian, is Theresa May going to survive through all of this? In number 10, I should qualify.
Yes, her overall chances of survival are very high indeed. Her chances of political survival are perilously low. I just can't imagine a scenario in which she makes it through to Christmas. And I hadn't really spoken to anyone who does. But then, you know, 2 months ago, I hadn't spoken to anyone who thought it was going to be a hung parliament, so that doesn't necessarily tell you anything. What's interesting is why she's being kept there. She's partly being kept there because of the hard Brexit system. She's still the best chance they've got of delivering. They're terrified of going back to the country because they think Jeremy Corbyn will win the next general election. And I agree, I probably would. However, there is another theory that sometimes does the rounds, which is basically that she's, you know, as I said before, being used as human shield. And that's that, you know, you're going to go in the next few months, you're going to have to make concession after concession after concession to Europe. All of the big chess pieces and stuff will go. We were given on the budget, we were given on EU citizens, given in any number of areas, and the damage that would do back home. So, I mean, basically, the plan then, according to this theory, is that May can take the bullets. You know, there's concession after concession on the budget, on EU citizens, all number of issues where Britain actually looks rather like it's being battered around by a much stronger partner. That's been the reality for 12 months, but no one's wanted to talk about it. So, let her take all those bullets, and then someone else steps in. Now, that seems to be the position of lots of the leading, that could be at least the position of lots of the leading leadership contenders, people like Boris Johnson, Michael Gove, in the Tory party. But it may also be the position of Labour, who, you know, Barry Gardiner for Labour has been very, very mixed in his response to the sort of idea of a cross-party committee, and that could well be, as people in Labour are thinking, look, Brexit is a disaster, it's going to be catastrophic, it's going to be humiliating. Let the Tories take those bullets, we will step in afterwards and clear up. That would probably be very good party political strategy. It would be very, very bad for the national interest. But, you know, we're not in an age where that takes top position in people's priorities, unfortunately.
Ian, thanks ever so much for joining us again on the Brexit podcast. Your views welcome, as always.
As always, thanks for listening. And if you enjoy the show, please feel free to subscribe to us and follow us on the usual social networks at Brexit Podcast and at brexitpodcast.com to stay up to date on all the best Brexit news and opinions. The show is produced by Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming and Warren Paul, and our theme song is courtesy of Kevin MacLeod.